offering our loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari Shankar. We go through the 1991 summer course series as part of this season of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. In fact, we are in the very last discourse in that series. We are somewhat near the midway of that discourse. For those of you who have not joined us as part of this discourse, this is a discourse that we have retranslated. The translation that you will hear will be in the voice of Brother Sunil of Radio Sai. Before we give you a brief summary of what we've been hearing from Swami in this discourse, and before we proceed to the clip that we are here to play today and speak about, at the very outset, greetings on Navratri to all of you. It's been a beautiful day here. The whole celebrations of Dashara has been going on for the past few days. So very hearty greetings from Radio Sai to all of you. And we welcome Hari also to the program. Saram Hari.
Saram Prem.
And I think more than anything else, I mean, we have had some very beautiful rains. We've been speaking about that. We have been having interesting programs and speeches. But some of the most interesting, in spite of all of that, seems to be that 10 minutes of discourse that we play in the evening. Mm. Because each one is actually so profound. We've taken from most of them from the 1980s, 84, 89. I think listeners, if any of you missed out, they can go back to our website and see those old videos. Very beautiful 10 minutes. And one thing which always strikes you is the message is same, and Swami did not tire one bit repeating it over and over again. Mm. You know, all of what we go through in this discourse, in this series, what we've gone through in the previous series, the message is the same. You know, Swami's emphasis on going within, understanding the underlying oneness. And when you look without, as we are seeing in this discourse, the emphasis on dharma, the emphasis on what you are supposed to do in each stage of life, in each situation that life puts you into. I think that is a message which is so very constant in whatever Swami speaks, and it's really, really beautiful that way.
Yeah, many people, you know, one of the experiences they relate, you know, when we speak to them, like, what are some memorable experiences you have of Swami? And usually they are the ones that, you know, the initial days when you come to Swami, and like, there's that so many, he actually treats you to a banquet of experiences,
right,
that draws you nearer and dearer to him. Many report this, you know, that they walked into the discourse, into the Kulwant Hall with some question in mind, and then Swami, just out of the blue, you know, they say that discourse sometimes is Swami is saying something, and Swami says something or drops a sentence very tangential, you know, which is a specific message to that person, and he gets it very clearly. The person, he or she, gets a very clear message that this is what Swami is saying, and that is why, you know, Swami is to actually have so much enthusiasm for speaking.
Right.
Right. Even when, you know, physically it used to, you know, even if it was difficult for him to stand and speak, or, you know, even in the last few years, it was like, you know, not even able to speak properly. But that used to motivate, you know, that there are people out there who are seeking this message, and I will stand up and deliver. So every discourse, most of us may not be able to appreciate it, but there is enormous feeling behind every discourse. There is great intent behind every discourse, and we should be treated that way, you know, that we should understand the love behind the discourse and listen to it with that feeling.
Right, absolutely. One thing which we always repeat is, you can catch Swami the happiest and the most benevolent when Swami has given something. Mm-hmm. You know, be it a distribution, or Swami has gone out and given saris and clothes, or Swami has given Padnamaskar. I mean, that's when he returns, Swami will be so happy. Mm-hmm. I mean, as students, when you're sitting in the portico or roundabouts, we know if that time you catch Swami, you can get what you're looking for. You know, your photograph signed, you can get vibhuti for somebody in the family, or get your tray blessed, whatever it is. Because that time Swami is really happy after he has given. And the same thing you can find after Swami has delivered a discourse. In fact, many times the joy that you find in Swami after he delivers a discourse seems to be pretty much higher than probably what Swami would have done when giving something material. Clearly showing that I mean, that is the time Swami is really giving, as Swami would say, what I have come to give.
Mm.
And that's when Swami is the happiest. And as you said, many times we may not be able to relate to the message, but we could oftentimes relate to that happiness which Swami had the end of that discourse. You know, we could feel the energy. I don't often like to put it that way, saying that I could feel the vibes, the energy. But you could feel that the mood was different after Swami delivers the discourse.
Yes. In fact, some listeners might not know, but sometimes during the summers, if Swami is in Vrindavan, there would be a discourse that he would deliver to the audience over there, and then Swami would go back into Trayi and again deliver a discourse standing. So that's like a total of 2 hours, Swami would be standing and speaking.
Right.
And I was told, you know, that in the evening, like those lucky few, used to sleep in Swami's room,
mm-hmm.
right? And Swami would actually sit and again summarize the discourse. Mm-hmm. He would ask, like, what did you understand from that? Mm-hmm. And then Swami would clarify, or they would get an opportunity to ask a few queries from what they heard during the discourse. So Swami, that much energy he had, and that was his intention. You know, when I really got first in touch with that was actually during the 80th birthday celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
See, the organizers, now an 80th birthday, any of these birthdays, they're held in the Hillview Stadium, mm-hmm. and it is a huge affair because people come in like tens of thousands or lakhs even to watch the proceedings. It's a massive affair. And the organizers, in their enthusiasm, they had included like some dance programs, music programs by great music luminaries.
Okay.
But we could see that, you know, like Swami actually, before the dance program could actually take off, he got it stalled.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, you know, people have not come here so that they can watch the dance program.
Mm.
They have come here to listen to the discourse.
Mm.
That's what they're here for, right? And then, which is, you know, we should understand this in sharp contrast to, like, what people would arrange during a program like that. See, you have so many people, you want to entertain the multitudes.
Mm.
But Swami wanted to transform them. And they may be two entirely different things mm-hmm. at times. And so that we should appreciate, you know, like maybe sometimes we do not really understand how precious these discourses are. Like.
In fact, there are some discourses, I think, from the 60s and 70s.
Mm.
We may not have the audio of those discourses, especially discourses given outside of Puttaparthi. When Swami goes and participates in a conference or in any other gathering, there are some discourses where Swami, in the course of the discourse, Swami makes a statement that actually I was not asked to speak. But I know that many of you here have come to listen to me speak. So that is why, even though I was not invited to speak, I chose to speak to all of you. And then those discourses will be considerably shorter, you know. So Swami kind of honors the schedule prepared by the organizers too. But Swami is saying that this is the most precious thing I can give. It's
correct.
Not just merely
exactly.
being in your midst. So I think we should constantly remind ourselves that this is the most precious legacy that Swami has left us with, and we really have to make complete use of that. And we've seen this in this series of discourse, just like any other series. I mean, the beauty of the wisdom that Swami is sharing, I mean, the way it covers a huge gamut. And even though we would say that 1991 discourse is about Upanishad, I mean, certainly it's not just about the most esoteric Vedantic truths. It is about that, but there is so much of practical wisdom also in it, which you can learn from it. The way the role a teacher has to play, the role a student has to play. I think all of that was covered in the course of the discourse, how you have to ask questions to your teacher and how the teacher sometimes answers, leaving gaps so that you can grow your understanding. I think all of that was explained in many parts. And coming to this discourse, I think this is probably the most practical of the lot, because it is all about dharma and all about doing the right thing. It's almost like 12 discourses. This is the 13th discourses. 12 discourses Swami has spoken about very, very profound and very deep truths. Almost hinting that if with all that knowledge it doesn't reflect in action, then it is of no point. I think that is also one of the points which Swami spoke, and is that the one which we concluded with, where Swami said, I think the last week,
yes.
The week before the previous one, where we concluded, Swami spoke about that, you know, if knowledge is merely in the mind, it's only bookish knowledge, it has to express an action. I think that's something which Swami always speaks, especially when talking about dharma. I think that is what it is, that informed action or informed choices. that you make. The thing is, what is dharma? And we've also spoken about that, where sometimes it's not the problem that we are not informed. The problem is we know, but yet there is a slip between the action and the knowledge. In fact, that is precisely the basis by which Vedanta looks at it, because it says that everybody knows what is the right thing to do. Nobody can claim that I didn't know. Everybody knows what is the right thing to do, because everybody has a conscience which dictates. Even if the mind is uneducated, the conscience always can point out to the right direction.
Yes, that's why the Vedanta doesn't endeavor so much to, you know, exhort a person to dharma.
Right.
As you rightly said, that in most practical situations, we do know what is the right thing to do. So the Vedanta works on the person you have identified with, because that is what comes in the way of your practicing dharma. The moment you take yourself to be the little body, you know, with and all the the psyche that goes along with it, the moment you take yourself to be that, or you identify yourself with that, then it's a, most of the times, a right thing, you know, to so to speak, would be for you to defend yourself or defend your people around you, etc. That would be the right thing to do.
Right.
You know, survival would be your goal, right? So therefore the Vedanta goes to work on you getting clear as to who you truly are.
Right.
There's a mistaken person that you have identified yourself with, and naturally you are therefore subject to every kind of sorrow, every kind of, you know, negative emotion. And so it tries to take you away from that, or rather go deeper into who you truly are. So it goes to work on the person, right? Rather than going on exhorting, like, this is the right thing to do, this is the right thing to do. It works on the fundamental basis.
Right. It's more of retreating what is already known, and it's more of a recalibration of the way you look at life and the way you look at yourself.
Yes, it alters your view of who you are. It alters a view of what the world is about.
Right.
And then the rest of the things flow very naturally.
Right.
So that's it. It makes it quite simple in that sense.
And that's how Swami starts this discourse. And Swami is made a beautiful reference to the two epics which are held very high in India, where you have Ramayana in one end and Mahabharata in the other end, where both of them have different kind of characters, but Swami is drawing the parallel where the authors actually hold out two characters, I mean, the characters who stand for dharma and righteousness higher, even though they seem to be losing out on many accounts. They end up on the wrong side of some of the decisions, and Swami still holds them up. And I think it's very important to understand, in fact, in the other program when we were talking about Bhagavatam, we have this huge chapter which speaks about Sukha Maharishi. You know, before he starts the Bhagavatam, there is this introduction to him, what a glorious personality he is. And even if you read about Sukha Maharishi, a person who is born a renunciant. You know, he is born and he becomes a sannyasi. He refuses to be born because he says the world is full of maya, I don't want to be born. And such a person, when asked the question, you know, what do you do to sanctify time? He says you have to listen to Bhagavatam. So it is not merely any character coming and giving the solution, but you have this background for this character, and he says that this is the solution. And that is the same thing with somebody like Vedavyasa, you know, who has this legacy behind him. He has mastered the Vedas, he has written the Upanishads, he has composed the Bhagavatam and all of that. And he holds out on character like Yudhishthira, and he says he's the ideal character. You can follow what he has done. And I think it's so counterproductive for us to question every action that he does. That's why, you know, Swami would say that try to understand why he did certain actions, but don't doubt every action that he has done. And, you know, we judge his actions based on our understanding, which is actually the other way it has to be done. You know, you have to see the action of such people and correct our understanding. I think that's why some of these epics have been held high. And that's what Swami was saying in the beginning part of the discourse about the Ramayana and Mahabharata being ideal texts that you can look at and correct yourself, rather than trying to comment or trying to point out errors in the characters in the epics.
Right, so that's one thing, we should look at what they contribute rather than us critiquing. Like, that's critiquing is an easy thing to do.
Right.
Because the attitude is one of learning. So, even as I'm listening to you, right now. So, the thing is, I'm looking for, what does that contribute to me right now? It's a bit selfish, but then that's the proper way to listen. If you want to learn, you got to listen for what does it contribute to me, rather than, sitting and dissecting it and analyzing what it's all about, right? So Actually, that is one of the attitudes which the Upanishads teach us. Not just the Upanishads, in world over, like in every scriptural text, you will find that they work a lot on the way you listen to that scriptural text.
Right.
Because that is very important, right? Mm-hmm. So that's in, you will find them, you know, like, for example, when we spoke about the Manusmriti, right, the Manudharma.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is very clear that the injunctions are there for what? So that you can attain liberation, right? So that it is very clear that what the way you have to listen to or read that text or listen to those injunctions is like, because it is a pathway, right,
right,
for your enlightenment. So it is very clearly laid out that this is how you got to read it.
Right? Mm.
You know, it's not like a novel. So given a novel, there is every which way that you can read it. So some people read it for the entertainment, and some people want to see the literary, you know, the techniques that the person has used, etc. So many ways of reading a book. But when it comes to a scriptural text, they are very clear that this is how you got to listen to it or how you got to read it.
Right. And the other point that Swami was mentioning was, it's important to understand some of these in the context of the nation, in the context of the region.
Mm.
And there is always this knowledge which is specific to that nation, specific to that region. And it's important to respect that and then to learn it. So Rami was talking about what works for India need not necessarily work for a different country. And similarly, what works for a different country can be taken. It's not like completely avoided. You know, it has to be applied to the local context. That's what Swami was saying. That you cannot import something as it is and then discard what is there in India. In fact, I think that was one of the points which Swami ends with, that no education or no modern science or no modern technology can negate the influence and the learning which the Indian scriptures provide.
Right.
And I think Swami was even making a reference to science, how it evolves. It's an evolving process where today it says something, tomorrow it modifies what it had said the previous day. And then it's constantly trying to learn and update that knowledge. So you cannot make that the basis of understanding something which has stood the test of time. That was one thing Swami was saying. And I think it was in that context Swami started speaking about Hiranyakashipu. And Swami would often say that Hiranyakashipu himself was a great scientist.
Right? Yeah,
Swami would often say that. Right.
And but yeah, so there, like Swami spoke about, like that how Hiranyakashipu, he goes through that episode of how Prahlada, you know, he questions Prahlada's devotion to the Lord, because
right,
the whole time he says that, no, I am the most important individual in this universe. Like, I am the Lord of this universe. There cannot be anybody else that you should worship. Because the entire, all the subjects of Hiranyakashipu used to worship him.
Mm.
And imagine having his own son denying that he is, you know, the Lord of the universe and saying that, I know who the Lord of the universe is and I'll point out to you who it is.
Right.
And Swami so beautifully explained, right, that the episode of where the pillar actually bursts open is like a moment of realization for Hiranyakashipu. That the episode of Lord Narasimha coming out of the pillar and tearing him apart, right, that is actually significant of him losing, you know, that identification with the body and therefore coming face to face with who he truly is. Right?
Right.
So that was, you know, that's how Swami was saying that while the we do learn science, while science has its own important place in our life, right, what we should avoid, like it applies to any field of knowledge, that having gained some mastery over that field of knowledge, we should look for whether it has developed some kind of ego within us.
Right.
And Swami says that if the ego is present, and there you have a pitfall right in front of you, right, because you could be blinded to what the truth actually is.
Right.
Yeah, you are so enamored of what you know, and you know you actually stopped learning beyond that. Right. So therefore, Swami says that, also one more caveat that Swami points out right at the end is to say that it's not about learning as much as putting into practice.
Right.
And, you know, there are also one more thing is, like, it is not for you to go out and give speech after speech, right, what you know. And no harm in that. Like, that is in itself a kind of service, right? But the what we should be aware is that there is a lot for us to learn.
Mm.
And so Swami says that practice an ounce and that is enough. And teach not by speeches but by your actual example.
Right.
And Swami used to say that there are so many who on the platform who are heroes. Mm. You know, on the stage they are heroes. But in real life they turn out to be zeros. And that is a pitfall. The moment you become enamored by your scholarship, your ability to expound on dharma, but a total inability to practice that in your daily life.
Mm.
That Swami is warning against. Yeah.
In fact, I think in the third or fourth discourse that we came through, Swami was talking about the purpose of life. And I think one of the initial discourses where Swami was talking about man's exploration and all that, there Swami made the statement that man has to look around, search for the truth, find it, put it into practice, experience it, and then share it with others.
Mm.
And Swami was telling that sharing is very important.
Mm.
In that, Swami was emphasizing on the sharing part.
Mm-hmm.
Swami said you have to share it with others and then derive the joy. But Swami was very clearly saying that you explore, you find the truth, and then you actually experiment it with your own life. It is not without that.
Correct.
I think that is where we miss out. You know, the moment we see something fascinating, we learn something fascinating, we are already keen on sharing it with others. I mean,
yes.
I'm not saying this about anybody else. I think we all feel that, especially when you have a platform to express your views, when we have limitless platforms to do that nowadays, actually.
No, because Swami, his instruction to us, you know, when he would guide us on speaking, he would say, Meeru anubhavinchindi adi cheppandi. You know, what you have experienced, you speak. Right, and of course, at you know, at certain stages, what you have is merely episodes that you have seen with Bhagwan. Right?
Right.
You may not have the maturity to actually understand their significance, etc. Right, but what you rightly said, that doesn't mean that you do not stop. You know, you take that learning, you put it into experience in a daily life, and then sharing it. Now, sharing it becomes important because that's how you keep it alive in your life.
Right.
Because the more you give it away, the more it accrues. That's the uniqueness of spirituality itself. Right?
Mm.
But as Swami, as you rightly said, you share what you have. Right? Sharing anything else, most of the people can see right through it. You're sharing some.
Like people are, as you're saying, most of us are waiting to do that, right?
Yeah.
When you tell something, we are constantly, rather than seeing how can I benefit from it, I'm constantly seeing.
Yeah.
Is it coming from the right source? Whether it's right or wrong, it's a different debate. But all of us do that. And as you say, that if there is any lacuna in that aspect, it really shows if someone is speaking something which they don't practice. Really.
Exactly. As one person very humorously observed, you know, you can distinguish between a person speaking from his lung and the other from his heart.
Right. I think that was where we ended. And in fact, as you pointed out, that beautiful point that Swami brought out about Hiranyakashipu seeing the Lord is not a simple act, but Swami is equating it to when the body consciousness is broken. It's not the pillar. The pillar actually represented body consciousness and that ego of Hiranyakashipu, that he knows everything. He has explored it. He has seen with his experimentation that God does not exist. And when that is broken, when that ego and that body consciousness is broken, Swami says that he has the vision of the Lord. And of course, we know that he eventually decimates Hiranyakashipu. But Swami says that actually it is a complete removal of the body consciousness. That's the whole process which is depicted in that scene. And it all comes from Prahlada, who's probably coming from very raw faith, right? His father is someone who has experimented and who has explored. But if you talk of Prahlada, it is pure faith. I mean, there is nothing that he has actually seen.
Childlike faith.
And all the experience actually follows that.
Yeah.
I mean, the experience of fire not hurting him, as you last time drew that parallel between that and that Bhagavad Gita shloka, where that faith that he has in the Lord leads him to the experience of really the atmic experience. It's not anything else, but the atmic experience of not being drowned by water, not being burnt by fire, not being crushed by weight. He experiences that, and that is what leads to Hiranyakashipu, the one who has explored through his mind to understand the inner significance of this whole episode. I think that's why we stopped. Probably we'll play out the clip for which we have for this week, and we'll discuss what Swami says in that.
ఈ ప్రపంచమంతా కూడాను రెండే రెండు పదార్థములతో కూడి ఉంటుండాలి.
The entire cosmos is defined by just two concepts.
ఏమిటవి?
What are they?
ఒకటి నామము, ఒకటి రూపము.
One is name and the other is form.
ఈ నామ రూపములు తప్ప ఈ ప్రపంచంలో మరి ఒక్కటి ఏది కూడాను మనకు కానరాదు.
Other than these two, the name and the form, nothing else are visible in this world.
ఈ నామము శబ్దము, ఈ శబ్దములోనే ఇమిడి ఉంటున్నది సమస్త జగత్తు.
This name is a sound. The entire universe exists on this sound.
ఈ శబ్దమే వాక్కు.
This sound is the speech.
వాక్కుకు ప్రాణమే భావము.
The life principle of speech is feeling.
భావములకు ప్రాణమే కోరిక.
The life principle of feeling is desire.
కోరికకు ప్రాణమే అజ్ఞానము.
The life principle of desire is ignorance.
అజ్ఞానములకు ప్రాణమే దివ్యత్వము.
The life principle of ignorance is divinity.
దివ్యత్వం అనేటువంటి దాని నుంచినే అజ్ఞానం ఆవిర్భవించింది.
Ignorance has manifested from divinity.
దివ్యత్వానికి వాక్కుకు సంబంధ బాంధవ్యాన్ని చేకూర్చాలి.
So we need to establish the correlation between divinity and the speech.
వాక్కు లేనటువంటిది ఏమాత్రం కూడా విషయాన్ని మనం గుర్తించుకోలేము.
We cannot recognize anything without speech.
ప్రతి దానికి ఒక శబ్దము.
For everything there is a sound.
శబ్దము నుండియే మనమంతా ఆవిర్భవించామే కానీ మనం శబ్దాన్ని మనం సృష్టించలేదు.
We all have manifested out of sound, and it is not that we have created it.
ప్రాచీన కాలం నుండి కూడా ఒక్కొక్క శబ్దమునకు ఒక్కొక్క అర్థం ఏర్పడుతూ వచ్చింది.
So from ancient times, a specific meaning was attributed to each and every sound. No scientist has created this meaning. This is a plate. Who has created this plate? This plate may have been created by a goldsmith, but who has given it this name?
పేరు ప్రాచీనం నుండి దానికి అలవర్తూ వచ్చింది.
ఫ్రమ్ ఏన్షియంట్ టైమ్స్ ఇట్ హాస్ బీన్ కాల్డ్ అ ప్రాక్టీస్ దట్ వే.
ఇది ఒక టంబ్లర్.
దిస్ ఇస్ అ టంబ్లర్.
టంబ్లర్ కు ఏది కారణము? ఈ యొక్క రూపమే దీనికి ప్రమాణం.
వాట్ డిఫైన్స్ దిస్ నేమ్ టంబ్లర్? ఇట్స్ ఫార్మ్ డిఫైన్స్ ఇట్.
కనుక నామమునకు రూపమే ప్రమాణము.
సో ద ఫార్మ్ ఇస్ ద ప్రూఫ్ ఫర్ ద నేమ్.
రూపమునకు నామమే ప్రమాణం. రెండు కూడా అన్యోన్యాశ్రయము, అన్యాభావ సంబంధము.
The name is the proof for the form. They are interrelated and intertwined. We must recognize this truth. In the world, each and every word has a form. Sorrow is a word, but the pain we experience is the form of this sorrow.
మనకు ఆనందము, ఆనందమునకు మనకు యొక్క అనుభవమే దీనికి స్వరూపం.
హ్యాపీనెస్, ఆర్ ఎక్స్పీరియన్స్ ఆఫ్ హ్యాపీనెస్ ఇస్ ఇట్స్ ఫార్మ్.
ఇది ఒక హాలు, దీనికి ఇదే ఒక స్వరూపము, ఈ స్వరూపమే దీనికి ప్రమాణం.
దిస్ ఇస్ అ హాల్, దిస్ ఇట్ సెల్ఫ్ ఇస్ ఇట్స్ ఫార్మ్, అండ్ ఇట్స్ ఫార్మ్ ఇస్ ఇట్స్ ప్రూఫ్.
అదే విధముగానే ఒక్కొక్క పదములకు కూడా ఒక్కొక్క స్వరూపం ఉంటూనే ఉంటున్నది.
ఇన్ ద సేమ్ వే, ఫర్ ఈచ్ అండ్ ఎవ్రీ వర్డ్ దేర్ ఎగ్జిస్ట్ అ స్పెసిఫిక్ ఫార్మ్.
కానీ ఈ సత్యాన్ని ఈనాటి భౌతిక శాస్త్రజ్ఞులు చక్కగా గుర్తించడానికి ప్రయత్నించడం లేదు.
బట్ టుడే సైంటిస్ట్ ఆర్ నాట్ ట్రైంగ్ టు అండర్స్టాండ్ దిస్ ట్రూత్ ప్రాపర్లీ.
ఒక్కొక్క డిక్షనరీ లోపల అనేక పదములంతా ఉంటున్నాయి.
ఇన్ ఎవ్రీ డిక్షనరీ దేర్ ఆర్ మెనీ వర్డ్స్.
ఆ పదములకు అనేకమైనటువంటి నానార్థములంతా ఉంటుంటాయి.
ఫర్ దోస్ వర్డ్స్ దేర్ ఆర్ మెనీ మెనీ డిఫరెంట్ మీనింగ్స్.
కానీ ఆ అర్థములంతా వాడు విశ్వసిస్తున్నాడా లేదా?
Are they believing the meaning of these words or not? They indeed believe. In the same dictionary, the word God also exists. For this word too, there must be a form associated, isn't it? If there is no such form, how then did this word come into the dictionary? Why are they not believing in this alone? This is merely an individual bias and not universal in nature.
తన యొక్క భావమును పురస్కరించుకుని, తన యొక్క సంక్షిప్తమైనటువంటి యొక్క తత్వాన్ని పురస్కరించుకుని దానిని అనుభవిస్తూ వస్తున్నాడు.
అకార్డింగ్ టు వన్స్ ఫీలింగ్స్ అండ్ నారో మైండెడ్ అప్రోచ్, వన్ థింగ్స్ అండ్ ఎక్స్పీరియన్సెస్ యాజ్ సచ్.
కనుక ప్రపంచంలో ఉండినటువంటిది రెండే, ఒకటి నామము, ఒకటి రూపము.
So, in this world only two exist. One is name and the other is form.
Kanuka.
Therefore,
Bhagavat Namamu Cheta, Namini Pattamani, Vedanta Prabodhistu Vachin.
Vedanta teaches that through God's name, the one described by the name can be got. It is very difficult to catch hold of the form through the form itself. If one is asked to bring a man who is wearing a pant and shirt, he is of a specific height, wearing a cap, how could anyone bring the person in this large audience? If a name is mentioned and said, bring this person, even if there are 100,000 people, the individual would come forward when the name is called out. With the name, we can attain the form easily. So it is said, Smarana, or calling upon God's name, is the means to Tarana, crossing this ocean of delusion.
So that was the next clip in this discourse where Swami is talking about, I think, a very important topic in Vedanta itself, the relationship between name and form and the way we relate to the world. I think many texts on Advaita also dwell on this topic. Well, I don't think I'm competent enough to comment on what Swami said, but it's pretty deep what Swami spoke about. But then Swami brings it to a point where we can completely relate to, where he talks about devotion, where how the form can be drawn towards you through the name. But we'll come to that later. Swami starts off by talking about name and form. Right, the whole of cosmos is defined by name and form.
In fact, when you were speaking about this, I remembered, see, when Swami speaks about the power of Namasmarana,
right,
he says the power comes from that. You know, it is like over the ages, like, you know, say people have been saying the mantra Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, right? So that mantra itself gains that power because people have repeatedly and it you know, over ages, that has that association with Lord
exactly.
Shiva.
Right.
That, he says, the mantra has that power because of this repeated association. He says even a mandir or any temple or any place of worship, we say it has acquired a certain power. And that power is actually because, like, people over the ages, right, they have frequented that place of worship, and it has become so strongly associated with the presence of God, with the presence of the Lord. So that creates the power, you know.
Right.
So Swami used to say that is why the name, that is one of the reasons why the name has that power, because of a very strong association with divinity, or the mantra has a very strong link with divinity. That's what endows it with, you know, that
right.
Power. And so what holds true of a place or you know, or divinity? And Swami gives that same analogy. He says, you could think about a physical object, like Swami gives the example of a plate. So when you and I say plate, there's a very clear association with what a plate is, right? And not only for something that is tangible, again intangible. Like when I say that I am worried, you immediately know what I'm talking about.
Right.
So there's a very clear association between the word worry and the actual experience of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Swami says then that when you say God, right, and therefore how can you deny the existence of something called God?
Mm-hmm.
That word has come into being because people have had an experience. It is not. It is something very intangible. Now, can people ask? Can you feel? Can you see God? Can you feel God? Can you measure God? Does he register on our instruments?
Mm-hmm.
And Swami says there are so many such things, right? And that, how did that word itself come into being?
Right.
Right. Did it come? Is it something? If a person has never ever experienced it, if there's no, if it is not a phenomena that people have experienced divinity in one form or the other, then how did it actually come into being as a word? Right. So Swami asked that very fundamental question, that how come we have not inquired along these lines. Right.
And of course Swami makes that beautiful point that, you know, he says that if you deny it completely, it's born out of individual bias. And when it is individual bias, you cannot universalize the idea.
Yes.
I mean, Swami says, he gives you that space. If you want to deny God, you deny God. Mm. But it's not a universal experience. It's not like any other things which you see and you say that it is there for the objects in front of you. It is not like that. I mean, as we've, I think, spoken of earlier also in the program, where it is as difficult to prove the existence of God as it is to disprove the existence of God.
Yes. So for most people, it's what they call as a Pascal's wager. Right? Mm-hmm. So they say that we do not know if God exists or not, but the, you know, the pitfalls of denying God, like if God exists, mm-hmm. and we have consequences for actions, etc., we'd better be on the safe side. So we worship God and, you know, seek His blessings, etc. Right? But what happens is, not everybody is able to experience that. You know, that insight or that sudden, you know, what they call as the parting of the veil, mm-hmm. right? Through which actually comes from a lot of inquiry or a lot of meditation, as what the sages went through, a lot of austerities, that opens the door.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And even we saw in the Kathopanishad it says over there, the Brahman chooses the person. Right? It is right. Brahman who chooses a person who can know it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, how do we get that deservedness? It's through a lot of austerities, or through a lot of inquiry, or through simply devotion to the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
As many episodes we see, you know, even Shankaracharya's disciple, right, Totaka, right? So he did not have any intellectual claims to understanding what his master was talking about. But he gained it through the Lord's grace.
Right.
And there is a lot of, therefore, something you have to put at stake in order for that veil to part, right? So you can distinguish, you know, there is, when we say that God does not exist for me, right? So there are two there are two attitudes that are inherent in that. So one is to say that God does not exist for me, in the sense that I am not very powerfully called by that concept called God,
mm-hmm.
you know. I am more drawn to, say, my duty. Or I'm more drawn to serving the people around me, which is totally, I mean, in itself, great. But the word itself does not, or the concept called God, devotion, that does not call me very powerfully, right? As against when you say that God does not have a meaning, as in the sense I close the door on the opportunity, or, you know, for God to ever occur in my life, right? So we said that, you know, there was one person who said, when he was questioned about God, like, do you believe or do you not believe in God, or mm-hmm. the existence of God? He very beautifully, he just said this much, that I have space for God to show up in my life. I have not crowded that out. I have not closed it out. Like, nor is it, you know, something that I can say, yes, I believe in God. Because for most of us, even what God is not clear, right? So mm-hmm. he said that very clearly. He said, I have space for God to show up in my life. I have not closed it out. So therefore, that arrogance, you know, even if you're not powerfully called, you know, by that concept called God, the arrogance to say that therefore God does not exist, that Swami says is, you know, that is not permitted. Like,
right. In fact, there's that beautiful quote in one of the novels, Dan Brown's novels. He has this character called Robert Langdon, who's supposed to be a symbologist, who is actually tilting towards an atheist. He studies all these scriptures and Bibles and the symbols of various religions, but he is not really a believer. In fact, there is that one conversation where one of the people from the church ask him, you know, Mr. Langdon, are you a believer? And he replies very beautifully in one sentence. He says that faith is a gift that I'm yet to be blessed with.
Beautiful. Yes,
right? Exactly. Because faith is a gift is actually a quote from the Bible, if I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. So he says, faith is a gift I'm not yet blessed with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is probably a better way of looking at it, as you're saying, that, you know, it's not something that has happened to me, but I'm open to the understanding.
Correct.
Right? Yeah. And that was what Swami was talking about, the form and name. But even before that, I think Swami was generally talking about how form and name literally defines the experience that we go through in our waking state, if you could put it that way. Everything in the cosmos, Swami says, is defined by name and form. But many times this question comes, you know, when you say name and form, what about people who are visually impaired and hearing impaired? In fact, that's what they talk about when you speak of characters like Helen Keller. I think she has this teacher who gives her the understanding. The first thing that he drives home to her is this understanding that there are objects with specific forms, and forms have specific a concept called word associated with that. It seems that is that was the toughest thing to put across to a person who could not see and could not hear.
Correct.
The idea that everything has a form and everything has a sound which is associated with that. And I mean, but I think as Swami is going on, Swami is explaining that, you know, when Swami speaks about sorrow and joy, it does not have a form, but you know that it is associated with a certain sensation. And probably these people who are visually challenged and hearing impaired, they might have a different association for what we call name and form, which we are not able to associate with really in that sense.
Correct. Because it does form some kind of like a pattern. So essentially you can put it down to a pattern, right? Like it, so when something, say they're touching water, right? So they know what water is, not by sight,
right,
but by the feel of it,
right?
Right. So the texture or feel. So there is a certain pattern in the brain which is associated. Maybe the component of vision is missing from that. The visual component is missing from it. But yet there is a pattern that is formed, and they learn to associate that pattern with a name.
Right.
Like, you know, like how do a person who is blind, what do they dream? Right. So it seems for them the sensation, all other sensations are present except that of, you know, the visual.
Right.
This thing, because the brain has never doesn't store that in its memory. It's only got the auditory, the listening, or only that is present, or the experience or the feel, right?
Right.
Only those are present, so it recreates only those in the dream. But yet it makes complete sense to the person who is dreaming, that it's completely a coherent series of actions. And they can delineate one from the other because they have a name associated with
it. That association is really important. In fact, I was listening to a discussion between two mathematicians. It was so really interesting because they were speaking in a language which, if you do not know the language of mathematics, you can't decipher. You're mathematical impaired in that sense. But they're actually communicating in a language. In fact, he was narrating a beautiful experience. One of those mathematicians, I don't recall his name, he says how he got fascinated with the idea of mathematics. He says when he's 8 year old or in his 8th grade or something, the teacher is teaching them the idea of how to plot a graph. And they're doing it with the help of the motion of a pendulum, right? So the shorter the pendulum gets, the faster the oscillation is. And they plot that thing and they time it. And when they do the thing, there's a beautiful graph. And he says when he saw that, there was a sudden sensation of seeing something so beautiful in nature. And the idea that there is some pattern in everything in nature, he says that drew me to mathematics at the age of 8 or at the age of 10 or whatever it is. That association with something which is periodic, something which has a pattern, which has a beautiful art to it, as they always say, you know, God speaks in the language of mathematics.
Totally. Yeah.
There's another mathematician, he says that, you know, how he gets fascinated. He says, if you take daisies, the number of petals in a daisy is always is a Fibonacci number, right? So he says that interested him because there is somebody who is leaving clues for man to find out, and probably for millions of years it was not even looked at.
Exactly.
You know, it has taken us million years to come to a point where we are looking at some simple things and seeing a pattern. I think it's about association. Like when we have all our senses prime, we are talking of a certain amount of association which is very natural to us. We don't even spend time to marvel at it. So probably even the people who have lesser senses in the sense of those who are differently challenged, the association which they make, we are not able to understand that because it's a completely different language.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. So that's why, like Swami says, no, essentially that name and form is, these two, they coexist essentially because of that constant association. So it has come, so the power that is attained, like, so as you were saying, like a mantra has that power because that constant association, right? In our minds, it is very, very clear that this mantra has that power. And that is the faith, you know, which creates that kind of magic, right? So I know so many, like in my own life itself, I know, like when we chant a particular mantra, it may seem like a complete, you know, for a person to scientifically, if you want to establish, like whether a mantra has power, it is very difficult to establish that. But that power we see in our experience. Mm-hmm. Right? I remember that, you know, as a student, actually once Swami had appeared in my dream, and I had asked him, Swami, I want to get close to you. Because this was uppermost on my mind, that when I used to come to visit Prashanthi Nilayam, my experience was this, that while sitting in the darshan lines, Swami would come down from his residence, and I would be praying from when we have entered the Kulwant Hall at around 4:30, and from that time I have been praying that, Swami, I want your Pad Namaskar. And then Swami would come, he would come, you know, a little to the right, he would grant Pad Namaskar to somebody. And within a tantalizing distance of my hand, he would move on to the opposite row. Right. And then I used to call this as the V cut, you know, he would go to the other side and then come back to the left of me and then proceed. So around me, people are happy that they've got Pad Namaskar, and I'm sitting there glum, you know. So this used to really has to get this thing that how will I get close to Swami? There must be some way, right? And while this was going on, one of the days, like, well, this was when I was studying engineering in Chennai, and Swami came in the dream, right? And in the dream, I'm sitting in Kulwant Hall, and again, you know, Swami is walking like a distance away from me. It wasn't Kulwant Hall, it was more like, you know, the old days where there was no hall as such, right? Only coconut trees and sand. So there I'm sitting, and Swami, he walks past and again ignores me completely. But this time a cry comes out from deep within my heart. I call out, Swami, you know. And then Swami turns and I ask him, Swami, why do you not talk to me? And Swami said that in the dream, he says, that is because you're weak. And luckily for me, I didn't take that, you know, lying down. I said, Swami, that's fine, but you tell me now, how do I become strong? How do I get closer to you? And Swami said, chant the Gayatri mantra. That's what he said in my dream. And after that, I, you know, for everything that was worth, I kept chanting, because I had that thinking, one day Swami will definitely talk to me. And I recall, I come here to Prashanthi Nilayam as a student of the MBA course. I'm sitting in Mandir one day and I'm again pained by this thing that Swami is not talking to me at all. And I, you know, I had composed one letter and I was, you know, praying that I should be able to hand it over to Swami myself. I sat in Mandir, I closed my eyes and I kept chanting the Gayatri Mantra, and two, in my mind, I had this faith that when I complete it, as Swami had promised, he will talk to me. So I and Swami had said, I remember asking him how many times to chant, and he told 108 times. So I kept chanting it, and around say the 104th or something, I heard that rustle. Okay, so Swami is out of the interview room, but I didn't open my eyes because I wanted to complete 108 times of chanting of Gayatri. So Swami comes out of the interview room, takes a round, and then, you know, walks towards where we are all sitting. I may be in the second or third row. And Swami comes, and as I finished the 108th time that I had to chant the mantra, I opened my eyes and Swami is standing there. He looked at me, he called me. Immediately, it was like, you know, that got over. The moment I finished the chanting, immediately he called me, took the letter, asked me my name and all those things. So that, for me, it's a very, very beautiful experience, and at least, you know, one or two others where Swami had acknowledged, you know, that there is power in this mantra. Right? And that power, now, can we analyze this scientifically? No. Right? So there is no other way. But for me, that it is so clear. The moment I finished, as promised, Swami called and spoke.
In talking about name and form, it comes to the thing which Swami would often, example of Swami would give, a very beautiful example. Swami would say, let's say the moment you say the word mango, right? The moment you say mango, let's say, I mean, it should be your favorite fruit. Otherwise, it doesn't, you know, work that way. So if mango is your favorite fruit, Swami says, the moment the word mango is spoken to you, you're already relishing the taste of a mango, and you know your mind goes back to a time when you would have relished a mango, or that emotion or that sensation of eating a sweet mango comes to your mind. But Swami says, if that same mango is right in front of you, Swami was saying that you will start seeing whether is it ripe enough, how is it smelling, you know, is it ready to eat.
Yeah.
So Swami is saying actually the form has more problems than the name. I mean, if you call the name, I mean, if you talk of even a form, you have a for instance, let's say you're talking of a plate. I mean, the example that Swami was giving, when you say a plate, you think of something which on which you can eat or on which you can use to place something. But let's say a plate which comes in front of you is a dirty plate. So the utility that you're associating with that name cannot be put into use. But that's what Swami is saying, that if you're talking of the name, you directly associate with the utility it is meant for. And that's what, when you talk about divinity, when Swami says that a name is associated with God and it has been passed on for so many generations and over a long period of time, that association with that name to purity, that association with that name to extremely and supremely compassionate being, I think that can never be taken away. And the delusion which the form can cause, I think we all been witness to. You know, when you're sitting in front of Swami, as you're saying, that one day that Swami turns that side, oh, Swami is angry with me. I mean, till that point, that idea of Swami being angry, upset or unhappy with you is never associated. But when we sat in front of Swami physically, Swami is in a bad mood today. Or, you know, somebody spoke to something to Swami there, so Swami's mood is upset. I mean, that's where the form has all of these delusions with that. But when you're sitting, and as you're saying, if you're probably chanting the Gayatri Mantra or taking Swami's name, the sensation that it creates is of that Swami who is absolutely benevolent and ready to shower His grace on you.
Yeah, that and the underlying message that Swami is giving is, it's your faith.
Right.
Ultimately. This innately, you know, like it, that is what is causing it, like, you know. So, as somebody said, like, what a miracle is actually the faith of the devotee meeting the grace of the Lord.
Right?
And Swami himself has said this several times. He would give the example of faith being the negative and God being the positive, of a battery terminal. And when you put them together, that's when the circuit begins to move, right? And so that was the association. So that is the crux of the message, that really what it's about is your faith. Right, and it's your faith that actually creates the rest of it, because that is the message of the Upanishads, that what you're seeing is actually what happens in the mind, right? And that act, or what you observing in front of you, at some place, a remote place inside you, are the cause of it.
Right,
you are at the cause of it. That, and there is no denying it, because the Upanishads hold you as the Lord Himself. This was one of the messages that came through, you know, from the Mandukya Upanishad.
Okay.
So when you are the Hiranyagarbha, at that stage you are the potentiality of everything.
Right.
And then you actually, in the Virat Sarupa, that is expressed. Right. So that very clear message. And that is where the faith comes in. Right. So faith has a very strong component in this entire association between the name and the form.
Swami ends with that beautiful analogy of calling out a person from the crowd. And Swami is saying that if you have to give the description of the person, then it's far more difficult than when you call out a name.
Yeah.
And it's easier to call out a person, and Swami is making that analogy, reference to calling out the name of the Lord. And again, it comes to that idea of faith. I mean, you're calling out to the being that you are associating with. In fact, Swami would speak about even this episode of Prahlada and Hiranyakashipu like that. You know, when Narasimha avatar comes, Swami would say that he was terrorizing for Hiranyakashipu, but Prahlada was seeing him as the most benevolent form, because that's how they had related to Narayana. And Hiranyakashipu thought of Lord Narayana as an enemy, but here was Prahlada who was looking at him as a refuge. And you know, Bhagavatam very beautifully says that the avatar is so much filled with rage and anger that all the other devatas are scared to see the form. So they go to Prahlada and say that he has come for you, only you can pacify him. And you know, you go to him and they in fact ask him, aren't you scared of the Narasimha avatar? He says, I am not, because I am not looking at the form, I am only looking at the feet. You know, that is out of his devotion. Finally he goes and pacifies the rage of Narasimhavatar. And so much so, it is like, what is the feeling that you associate with that name when you call out to Swami? That's why Swami would say, I think one of the youth group Swami said, that Swami told them, don't associate Swami with the idea that, you know, oh, Swami is like this, or Swami does not care, Swami does not bother about us. Because you are creating that image of God for yourself, you know, so much so. Swami said, try to avoid that as much as possible. I mean, you wonder, if Swami is all love, how can me thinking of it change that nature? But it does matter, you know, what going back to what Swami spoke about in one of those discourses, where he spoke about the every thought becomes, will have to take form when it comes into the physical plane. And I think that is why it's very important to work on that faith, right? So I think we'll end with that. We're running out of time. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining us. Do join us again next week. We have a couple of more clips to, before we complete this discourse and of course complete the series too. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. We thank you all for joining us. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his guest for the day for the Vahini Satsang, the last segment of today's Thursday Live. Once again, Navratri greetings to all of you. Do join us again next week at 7:30 for the next episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam.